attorneys to you, but we cannot provide you funding. So then I wanted to escalate it to the director. And so we had a meeting with the director and the program manager. And I pushed back a little and I said, I can't help who did this. Where do I go? How do I get help? How do I get a women's organization to help me? And her response was, keep in communications with us. Our attorneys that have advised us our 501c3 could be at risk because it's a presidential election and we can't appear biased. So I accepted that response at that time.
We have 5 seconds, Tara.
Anyway, what I would say is there's been no access to justice for me. And there, in the fall, there's no democracy for me.
Tara Reid, I want to thank you so much for being with us, former staff assistant to then-Senator Joe Biden. She alleges that Joe Biden sexually assaulted her in 1993. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by an amazing group of people, Mike Burke, Dean Augusto, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the number of coronavirus cases in Oregon and across the country continues to rise. Schools are preparing for the possibility that students may not be able to return to the classroom for the remainder of the school year, and Democratic lawmakers are calling out the lack of racial and demographic data in COVID-19 testing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority announced 84 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total up to 690. With more on the update of our coronavirus numbers, we go to KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu.
Health officials also announced 2 new deaths, a 90-year-old man in Yamhill County and an 88-year-old woman in Benton County. Both had underlying medical conditions. This brings the state's total death toll up to 18. Governor Kate Brown tested negative for the novel coronavirus after showing symptoms of a cough during a video conference with local media. Providence Health and Services announced on Monday that 10 of its employees have contracted the virus. Legacy Health also confirmed that 8 of its workers have tested positive. Oregon Health Sciences University said that 12 of its healthcare workers have tested positive. This brings the total number of known healthcare workers in Oregon with the novel coronavirus up to 31. However, the exact number remains a mystery. Kaiser Permanente has declined to release information on whether any of its workers have contracted the virus. This comes the same day as the healthcare union going public, stressing the dangers faced by frontline workers during a shortage of basic personal protective equipment like face masks, gloves, and gowns. In Washington state, there have been 4,896 confirmed cases, including 195 deaths. As of Tuesday morning, 116 of those cases are in Clark County. A model predicting state-by-state COVID-19 deaths and resources use has shown that Oregon could be making progress flattening the curve. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation developed the analysis, which is updated daily. As of Tuesday morning, the model showed no bed shortage in Oregon, and the peak hospital resource use date has shifted nearly 2 weeks from April 24th to May 6th. Projected fatalities are also down in Oregon. However, Washington State's updated outlook is not as promising. The state is still expected to face a shortage of ICU beds, and the total projected deaths have increased. The number of cases in the U.S. continues to rise quickly. As of Tuesday afternoon, at least 183,532 people across every state, plus Washington, D.C., and four U.S. territories have tested positive for the virus. CNN anchor Chris Cuomo has tested positive for COVID-19. However, he will continue working from home. Nationally, there have been at least 3,727 deaths. Globally, the pandemic has sickened more than 839,200 people across 171 countries, and at least 41,343 people have died.
Oregon schools are facing the possibility that students may not be able to return to the classroom for the remainder of the school year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, school districts are implementing a campaign called Distance Learning for All to ensure students can continue their education during the crisis. KBOO's Yasmin Kobanoglu has more.
Oregon Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Colt Gill, has sent a letter to superintendents and principals throughout the state outlining the possibility that students may not be able to return to classrooms for the remainder of the school year. Instead, schools may have to rely on online learning, with many districts rolling out distance learning lesson plans this week. Governor Kate Brown has already ordered all schools to be closed until April 28th. Education officials are now starting a campaign called Distance Learning for All. Gill said that all districts should have distance learning in place by April 13th. However, he also acknowledged that many teachers may lack the skill sets initially to enact online teaching, and could instead substitute with printed lesson packages. Portland Public Schools is scheduled to start distance learning on April 6th. Parents have already received letters outlining how the district plans to launch the online instruction. District officials have also rolled out guidelines that include limits on instruction time for more than 3,500 teachers across every grade, from kindergartners to seniors in high school. According to district documents, officials are still figuring out a pre-kindergarten strategy. Elementary school teachers are advised to spend no more than an hour each on language arts and math instruction, and are also asked to limit screen time for their youngest students. Arts and physical education teachers are being urged to schedule at-home activities for their students. Special education staff is instructed to check in with families at least once per week, scheduling meetings around a student's individualized education plan as necessary. Many students do not have access to computers at home, so last week, the district began offering online signups for families who need to borrow from the district stock of 45,000 devices. Oregon Education Association President John Larson said, quote, "It is crucial that our elected leaders ensure that students aren't penalized for an inability to thrive under these new circumstances."
Some frontline workers in Oregon are relying on homemade cloth masks as the crisis over protective gear during the coronavirus pandemic continues to grow. Eric Tigadoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Oregon workers on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic are in desperate need of protective gear. Masks and gloves are in short supply or non-existent in hospitals and grocery stores and for home care workers across the state. Head of the Oregon Nurses Association, Sarah Laslett, says emergency room nurses in Portland are wearing swim goggles because there are no more face shields.
On the coast, they are storing their dirty masks in paper bags and Rubbermaid containers to reuse again. And in Central Oregon right now, some of our nurses have been wearing the same N95 mask for 3 weeks straight.
Governor Kate Brown is calling on the federal government to release more personal protective equipment from the Strategic National Stockpile. Alicia Houlihan is an emergency department technician in Springfield and SEIU Local 49 member. She says workers are being asked to wear one surgical mask for 12-hour shifts. She says hospital workers were approved to wear cloth masks last week.
That is not acceptable. As we see, we need this essential equipment to be able to handle the surge and anticipate all the people that are going to be coming in.
Oregon Representative Suzanne Bonamici says members of Congress are pushing the White House to release more masks for essential workers in Oregon.
There's no reason why any piece of PPE should be sitting in a closet or a stockpile right now. It needs to get on the hands and faces and bodies of people who are saving lives.
For many, the threat from unsafe conditions doesn't stay at work. Irene Hunt is a home care worker and SEIU Local 503 member. She says she has no PPE available to her and that her daughter has been staying with her 70-year-old mother-in-law since last week.
I had to drop my daughter off Monday and I have not been able to pick her back up to make sure that they stay safe because I'm afraid.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Democratic lawmakers are asking why there is an apparent lack of racial data in coronavirus testing. They say this data is necessary to monitor and address disparities in the national response to the COVID-19 outbreak. This comes as cities with large Black and Hispanic populations emerged as new hotspots for the spread of the virus over the weekend, including Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, and New Orleans. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Ayanna Pressley, both from Massachusetts, sent a letter to Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar asking why comprehensive demographic data does not exist. The letter to Azar said in part, quote, "Any attempt to contain COVID-19 in the United States will have to address its potential spread in low-income communities of color. First and foremost, to protect the lives of people in those communities, but also to slow the spread of the virus in the country as a whole." Lawmakers urged Azar to direct the department's sub-agencies, such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration, to work with municipalities, states, and private labs to ensure that racial and ethnic data is being collected. The letter also cited chronic health conditions and health care access disparities. In addition, people of color and immigrants are less likely to be insured, leaving many without access to quality health care. Warren later added in a statement, quote, "Decades of structural racism have prevented so many Black and brown families from accessing quality health care, affordable housing, and financial security, and the coronavirus is blowing these disparities wide open." Portland police are searching for a suspect accused of killing a man at a Southeast Portland shopping complex. Police responded to the scene at the parking lot of a popular shopping complex near 82nd Avenue and Powell Boulevard, which houses Winco Foods, Gen X Clothing, and several other small businesses, at around 3 p.m. yesterday. Upon arrival, officers found the victim had died of gunshot wounds in the parking lot near USA Pawn and Jewelry. Several witnesses on the scene attempted to help the man using a sweater to attempt to stop the flow of blood and performing chest compressions as well as mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. The victim briefly started breathing again, but soon stopped. Police have not yet released any details relating to the circumstances surrounding the shooting. A 51-year-old Lakewood, Washington man has been arrested on charges of driving under the influence, reckless driving, hit and run, and felony eluding. The man, who has not been identified, led Washington State troopers on a high-speed chase along Interstate 5, at times exceeding speeds of over 100 miles per hour. Trooper Heather Axman said the man was driving very erratically as he tried to evade law enforcement, at one point driving onto a pedestrian and bicycle path. Troopers eventually resorted to spike strips to stop the car, ending the chase. Upon approaching the vehicle, police found that the suspect was not in the driver's seat, however his pet pit bull was. The man attempted to convince the troopers that he was trying to teach the dog to drive. Axman stated, quote, "I wish I could make this up. I've been a trooper for almost 12 years, and wow, I've never heard this excuse. I've been in a lot of high-speed chases, I've stopped a lot of cars, and never have I gotten an excuse that they were teaching their dog to drive." The man is being held on an $8,500 bond. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for two in-depth interviews. First, KBOO's Ken Jones will be speaking with Mercy Corps about their work around coronavirus. Then on We Are All In This Together, Suzanne LeGrand interviews Teresa Estrada, a personal chef and seamstress. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX, and at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be overcast with occasional rain showers and a low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 50. Today in history, in 1959, the Dalai Lama crosses China's border into India, where he is granted political asylum after fleeing the Chinese government's suppression of a national uprising in Tibet. The quote of the day is from the Dalai Lama, who said, quote, "If you think you are too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito." On Monday, the governor of Idaho, Brad Little, signed two bills into law that limit the rights of transgender people. One measure bans transgender girls from playing on girls' and women's sports teams. The second measure prohibits transgender people from changing their gender on Idaho birth certificates. House Bill 500, or the so-called Fairness in Women's Sports Act, prevents transgender girls from playing on athletic teams or sports designated for females, women, or girls. The measure adds that an athlete's gender can only be determined by examining, quote, the student's reproductive anatomy, genetic makeup, or normal endogenously 19-produced testosterone levels. The other measure, House Bill 509, prohibits transgender people from obtaining a new Idaho birth certificate with their corrected gender identity. In 2018, a federal court struck down a similar bill that sought to prevent gender from being changed on birth certificates. The American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho said both laws violate the rights of transgender people. A statement from the ACLU said, quote, "The ACLU of Idaho condemns Governor Brad Little's decision to sign discriminatory, unconstitutional, and deeply hurtful anti-transgender bills into law. Leaders from businesses, faith, medical, education, and athletics communities will not forget this decision of what it says about the governor's priority during a global pandemic. The ACLU will see the governor in court." The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on Tuesday that Texas will be allowed to implement its temporary ban on abortions. Under the order, any abortion that is not medically necessary to preserve the life or health of the patient must be halted as a part of the state's directive to suspend any non-essential medical procedures during the coronavirus pandemic. The ban was briefly lifted on Monday when a lower court ruled that suspension of abortion services was unconstitutional and in violation of Supreme Court precedent, including Roe v. Wade. Texas is one of five states facing legal battles over restricting abortion access during the COVID-19 pandemic. The other states are Alabama, Iowa, Ohio, and Oklahoma. A coalition of abortion rights groups, including the Center for Reproductive Rights, Planned Parenthood, and the Lawyering Project, have challenged the bans in federal court. So far, judges have ordered the bans in Alabama and Ohio to be lifted. In Tuesday's ruling, three federal judges issued a temporary stay, allowing the ban on abortions in Texas to remain in place. The groups challenging the state's suspension of abortion access have until Wednesday morning to file a response. Tomorrow is Census Day, and children's advocates want to make sure that the census includes everyone, especially infants and young children. With more on the story, it's Andrea Sears with the Public News Service.
Wednesday is Census Day, and despite the coronavirus pandemic, the U.S. Census is still happening, but children's advocates fear kids will be undercounted. The census is based on where you and your entire family live on April 1st. In 2010, the census missed more than 25,000 Pennsylvania children. That meant a loss of nearly $44 million of federal funding for the state. Children of color are most likely to be undercounted, and this year immigrants are especially concerned that participating in the census could put them at risk. But Deborah Stein, with Partnerships for America's Children, points out that the census mandate is to count everyone living in the United States, and it does not pose a threat to those who are undocumented.
You don't have to identify people's citizenship or immigration status, but we are still very concerned that we'll miss a lot of immigrant children.
She adds that information on individuals gathered by the census cannot be released for 72 years, and there are stiff penalties for violation of that privacy protection. Will Gonzalez is executive director of the Philadelphia-based nonprofit SABA. His group has been doing census outreach in the immigrant community for a year, answering questions and addressing fears.
When you engage in those discussions with immigrants, they understand it. and they recognize the value for the community and their children.
He believes that many immigrants welcome the opportunity to participate in the census because it promotes a sense of belonging and an affirmation that this is home. In a recent survey, 10% of families making less than $50,000 a year said they would not count their infants, toddlers, or preschoolers. Stein emphasizes that all funding for schools and other vital services depends on getting a complete count.
Make sure you count everybody from birth on in your household, whether you're related to them or not, because the consequences of missing a child lasts a decade, and that's most of their childhood.
To ensure a complete count, the Census Bureau has extended the period for self-response to the census questionnaire by phone, mail, or online to August 14th. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, many are advocating for an expansion of mail-in ballots. Some even say that restricting voting by mail is one method of suppressing the vote. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
I do think that voters receiving a ballot in the mail might some way boost participation. This is where the state just needs to make sure that it prioritizes public outreach.
Common Cause Maryland's Joanne Antoine on her state's efforts to expand vote by mail ahead of primaries postponed from April until June. But she worries that a recent decision by the Maryland Board of Elections to cancel all in-person options could leave a number of voters disenfranchised.
This includes voters who, for whatever reason, just can't receive mail at home, or maybe they've changed their address and it hasn't been updated yet. This includes folks who need to be able to use a ballot marking device, and a number of other voters just needing assistance who can't print ballots at home, and even inactive voters, eligible voters who want to take advantage of same-day registration. So there's just a lot of barriers when that in-person aspect is removed.
Some states typically have restrictions on their absentee voting, such as requiring folks to have certain reasons, like a disability, being either a college student temporarily out of state, or an overseas service member. Various states, many with Republican-controlled legislatures, use other forms of voter suppression. Brennan Center for Justice Counsel Max Feldman says there's been
a wave of new voting restrictions in states across the country since about 2011. And I'm talking about laws like strict voter ID laws, cutbacks to early voting, new obstacles to voter registration, things like that that make it more difficult to get on the voter rolls, stay on the voter rolls, and cast an effective ballot.
The new coronavirus pandemic exacerbates many of these problems. Most recent primaries in Arizona, Florida, and Illinois went on as planned, but many polling sites had complications. Some Illinois locations didn't have proper sanitizing equipment. Two Florida poll workers recently tested positive for COVID-19. Hawaii, Alaska, and Wyoming all canceled in-person polling this Saturday, sending ballots to every voter instead. Joanne Antoine says her state, Maryland, is not the only one having to rush changes.
How do we ensure that everyone who is supposed to get a ballot gets it in their hand on time? You know, how do we ensure that the canvassing process afterwards is clear and secure and that we, you know, get our results in a timely fashion?
Yesterday, President Donald Trump, in an interview with Fox News, explained why he thinks a national vote-by-mail standard didn't make it into last week's $2 trillion stimulus bill. Quote, they had things, levels of voting, that if you ever agreed to it, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country again, unquote. Trump's presumptive Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, also got a boost. Two Democratic super PACs are joining together to support Biden in his campaign to replace Trump. The new partnership is co-chaired by former governors Jennifer Granholm of Michigan and Deval Patrick of Massachusetts, also a former presidential candidate. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Cases of COVID-19 continue to rise on Navajo land. The governor of New Mexico is pressuring the president for more coronavirus aid, and powwow dancers are turning to the internet to share their skills. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As of Monday, 20 new positive cases of COVID-19 and 3 additional deaths were reported by Navajo health departments. Positive cases on the Navajo Nation have reached 148, with 5 COVID-19 related deaths. Navajo leaders and health officials are urging Navajo citizens to stay home and follow emergency orders to help slow the spread of the coronavirus. A curfew went into effect Monday night as Navajo police began roadblocks. The National Guard is working with the tribe to help provide some relief for medical staff and personnel in the community of Tuba City, Arizona, where medical tent facilities went up Sunday at the local fairground. Tribal leaders are holding a virtual town hall Tuesday to provide COVID-19 updates. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham raised concerns about the Navajo Nation, warning the virus could wipe out some tribal nations. ABC News reports Lujan Grisham expressed her worry during a call Monday with President Trump and governors. She's requesting federal aid for New Mexico and reportedly told the president she has yet to receive a response. Meanwhile, the National Indian Health Board is working with federal agencies to get much-needed COVID-19 funding and resources to tribes. Tribes have raised concerns about funding sources and wanting relief dollars to go through the Indian Health Service because the agency has authority to deliver funds through self-governance and self-determination, contracts, and compacts. According to the National Indian Health Board, more than $1.5 billion has been secured for tribes to address COVID-19 in areas of healthcare, mental and behavioral health, housing, and nutrition. The group is also working with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to help get funds to tribes. As in-person spring powwows are put on hold, Native dancers across North America are sharing their skills online. Powwows, tribal events, and large gatherings have been postponed or altogether canceled due to the coronavirus. But Indigenous people are coming together on social media to share their drumming, dancing, and regalia. China Lockett has more.
Social media has helped thousands of people see 16-year-old Wakia Kuni and his 14-year-old sister Wechakpi Cook dance. The two are Oglala Lakota and live in Washington State. They compete at powwows across the country and usually travel a lot in the summer. But that won't happen this year. So instead, they put on their regalia and danced in their front yard. Their mother recorded the performance and posted the video on social media. Wakia Kuni explains the roots of his grass dance.
Back then, like, the grass should be really tall. So they would have all the grass dancers go out and dance before everybody to light on the grass, so that he would be ready to dance on for everybody else.
His sister, Wechakpi Cook, danced in her jingle dress. It has about 200 metal cones sewn onto it that make noise when she moves. The siblings usually compete in separate categories, so dancing in their yard together is a treat.
It's fun dancing with my brother and having him by my side.
Yeah, I think it's pretty fun.
A Facebook group called Social Distancing Powwow shares a variety of traditional performances. It's the creation of Whitney Rencounter. He's Oglala Lakota and based in Rapid City.
The platform has been created for them to share these songs and dances, and so that's why I think it's just going viral for everybody, because it's the right time and it's important to share the talents and the songs, dances, and artistry and languages and all these things that I think throughout the world we never really had a platform for to provide that.
For National Native News, I'm China Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Khan, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Eric Tegadoff, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland is joined by guest Bob Nickel, a former Oregon Commissioner for Mental Health and Addiction, to talk about stress, anxiety, and coping during the COVID-19 pandemic. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon, discussing the new Westside QRC project with Board Chair Shannon Walton Clark and Board Member and Activist Beach Pace. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show. Host Tori Bortman talks with the director of the Legacy Research Institute Biomechanics Lab, Michael Botling, and orthopedic surgeon Dr. Steve Madley about why helmets may not be as safe as you think and how some experts are trying to change that. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The coronavirus pandemic now extends to nearly every country in the world, and Mercy Corps is there to provide support and humanitarian aid to communities hit hardest by the virus. That includes communities here in Oregon and Washington State, which is served by Mercy Corps Northwest. To find out more about the organization's mission and how you can access their services, we're joined now via Skype by Lynn Rankin, Executive Director of Mercy Corps Northwest. Lynn, thanks for taking time out to talk with us today at KBOO.
Happy to be here.
Well, Lynn, first, how are you holding up? Are you working from home?
I am working from home. I've got two kids that are out of school, out of PPS, and trying to keep them busy and active while working from home.
Now, before we get to Mercy Corps Northwest's response to the coronavirus pandemic specifically, what's the organization's mission during more normal times?
You know, we work to alleviate poverty and suffering and increase productivity in about 40 countries all over the world. And obviously this time has really impacted each one of those countries differently, but significant impact on all of our operations around the world. And every country is probably impacted differently.
Now let's concentrate more, focus more on Northwest. On your website, you use the term micro-enterprise, and those are basically businesses with five or fewer employees, what many of us refer to as mom-and-pop shops. What surprised me is that those micro-enterprises make up about 86% of all businesses in Oregon and Washington. They're critical, in other words, to the regional and national economy, especially when it comes to job creation.
That's right. I mean, they are the backbone of our society, of our economy. They're the fabric of our communities, and are responsible for our economic growth in Oregon and Washington. So very important to consider. It's not just the big companies out there, but it's small businesses, it's micro entrepreneurs, it's maybe a woman making something in her home and sells outside of her home. You don't even know there's a business there. So those are a vibrant part of our economic landscape.
Yeah, I want to get into that too, some of the demographics of your clients. Your site mentions that 80% represent people of color, immigrants or migrants, and other marginalized groups.
Correct. And we operate the only women's business center in the state of Oregon with support from the Small Business Administration. So a lot of our clients are also female or identify as female. So we see probably 70% of our clients, somewhere between 60 and 70% or more of our clients are female identifying.
And also about one in three I saw on the website are people of color. So that's Hispanic, African American, Asian, American Indian.
We have Russian speakers and we have Arabic speakers on our team. So we work with those communities in particular significantly. But yes, all refugees, migrants, people of color, all different types of people come in and use our services.
And also majority are at or slightly above the federal poverty line. So these are low-income business owners and entrepreneurs.
They are low-income individuals who have been, many of them have historically been marginalized or not received the same opportunities, maybe myself or other Caucasian citizens have received.
I just have to interrupt you. I hear the kids in the background. That's actually kind of a very comforting sound.
And they're outside.
Oh, wow. Well, getting back, the small business owners that we talked about, and that represents quite a demographic there, they're especially hard hit during this crisis. So what are you seeing in terms of their concerns and needs, and how is Mercy Corps Northwest addressing those issues?
Right. So we've identified those small businesses that we feel have been significantly impacted. Those are retail businesses. Many did not have significant online presence or none at all. Client facing, could be service industry jobs as well. They are worried about keeping employees if they have employees. They are worried about making payroll, and they're worried about keeping their staff healthy, and they're also worried about making rent. And then, you know, you hear other stories about, you know, people are just trying to survive and keep their cart open. They've got issues around, you know, previously their suppliers are no longer their current suppliers, irregularity of business. I talked to one person the other day who, you know, in the entire day had served, you know, one to-go order, whereas in the last hour, he had served 17 customers. So it's just like widely erratic, hard to plan. And then obviously a lot of people are anxious for a whole host of different reasons. We're all operating differently than we had been before. So it's just a time of heavy uncertainty, hard to plan, and people have real worries, especially that had brick and mortar operations that are now shut or operating at significant reduced capacity.
Now, can you walk us through the process of how a small business owner would go about requesting aid? How do they apply, and how do you determine if they qualify for support from Mercy Corps Northwest?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the City of Portland, through Prosper Portland, has an emergency grant fund that is open, that opened as of this morning for hard-hit businesses like the ones that I've just described. That application is on Prosper Portland's site, so people can go and have a look at that. I think it will be closing, close of business this Wednesday, but it is active as of now, which is Monday. So that's one opportunity. And I think many cities around Oregon, Forest Grove, Hillsboro, Gresham, Beaverton, have similar emergency funds open right now, all geared at providing immediate relief to small businesses in certain locations. So as I said, there's one in Portland, and then there's one around, several around the state that I'm aware of, and around the country. You know, Mercy Corps is seeking funding to provide support, grant support to small businesses, hard-hit small businesses. And so that's what's in our plans for the future right now, is to continue to provide business education to clients that have been hard-hit by the COVID-19, and then also to get money into the hands as quickly as we can into impacted small businesses through emergency grants. We also are an alternative lender. And so we've made some deferment with our existing clients around loan payments. We also are part of the state of Oregon's IDA initiative, the Individual Development Account. And with that, people are able to use some of their savings that they have, that they are working towards.
Now, you mentioned the funding there with grants, government grants, foundation grants, but also individual contributions. On the website, It said that for every $1 of individual contributions, you generally get about $4 in the government and foundation grants.
That's right. That's across the board with Mercy Corps. I think those are some figures that we use regarding fundraising.
And how can listeners help support the efforts of Mercy Corps Northwest?
As I said, Mercy Corps is actively looking for funds. Mercy Corps Northwest is actively looking for funds. People can visit our website. The Mercy Corps Northwest website is mercycorpsnw.org. That's mercycorpsnw.org. You can take a look at what were some of the businesses that we're trying to support during this period on the site, and we're also actively fundraising to support those small businesses in need.
Yeah, actually, that's a great list of resources. I noticed that it's not just for the small business owners, the moms and pops, but also for just the general population, where to find free food, how to entertain your kids, and how to support each other's businesses. And you have a list of some of those mom and pop shops and how listeners can go ahead and try to keep them in business.
Right. I think people normally think about when we need supplies, we're going to Fred Meyer or whatever your Target or whatever. But there's a lot of different small business stores that are open throughout the Portland area that are very well stocked and are not often top of mind for people. So we want to encourage and drive traffic to those locations throughout the area, so that they enjoy staying open, because they're fighting more than anyone to pay their bills and stay open during this time.
And I know some of them have had to adapt and get creative during this time. Some are offering online classes because people can't come in. Takeout and delivery for a lot of the restaurants. Gift cards, always a good idea for future purchases.
That's right. Anything we can do right now to keep a vibrant small businesses afloat as we started out. I mean, small businesses are the backbone of our economy, and I think people don't really realize that. Bigger stores come to mind, but they are the fabric of our economy and of our neighborhoods, and we absolutely need to ensure that they stay open, and then hopefully as this comes to a slows down, this epidemic slows down, that they are vibrant as soon as they can be.
Now, this wasn't on the website, but recently Congress passed a stimulus bill, and I think some of the reports were that it helps the bigger companies and corporations and doesn't do as much for small businesses. Have you looked into that? Is there anything in the stimulus bill that will help your clients?
I think there's a lot that we don't know quite yet, or we don't understand how it will work. And we just want to ensure that funds do reach small businesses as much as possible. You know, there's a lot out there that's changing every day, including some emergency loans that are offered by the SBA, the Small Business Administration, that, you know, things are out there, but how they're working and how they unfold, we don't quite understand yet.
You've also adapted, a Mercy Corps has adapted, and you're offering online classes and webinars over the next few weeks. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the offerings coming up and how people can find out more? Again, probably the Mercy Corps Northwest website.
That's right. All of our information, especially now, is on the Mercy Corps website. What we've done is really pivot from attracting, helping people to start their own business, to understanding what the pain points are of those small businesses and trying to be relevant and provide answers to people based on their needs. So maybe some small businesses out there are lucky enough to receive some grant funding or get a loan to help them during this time. You know, people helping to coach people through how to best use the resources during this time. You know, that's one such webinar. Understanding personal finances and your credit score, that remains very, very relevant. Helping people that don't have an online presence, how do they switch to an online presence? Things like marketing and branding are always so important. Offering counseling with our volunteer business counselors. All of that remains really important to people. We're hearing about their pain points and trying to respond as quickly as we can with relevant content.
Well, I'm really glad that Mercy Corps Northwest is there, Lynn, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us about it and for all you and the organization is doing.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Lynn Rankin, Executive Director of Mercy Corps Northwest. You can find out more about Mercy Corps Northwest and help support their work online at mercycorpsnw.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
From leaders and experts about the pandemic. But today I thought I would talk to local Portland residents about how they are experiencing the pandemic and what in their lives has changed. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and today on We Are All in This Together, I am speaking with Teresa Estrada, who is a personal chef and also a professional seamstress. Could you tell me a little bit about what you do?
I'm a private chef, and my main client is a medical clinic in Corbett called Haishan. And I cook at home on Sundays, and then I take all the food to them on Mondays. Also out at Trout Lake Abbey, they have, it's a retreat center. It's a Buddhist monk temple, and they have all kinds of retreats. So I was scheduled to do a 10-day retreat that got canceled. I was scheduled to do a Reiki retreat that got canceled, and I was scheduled to do a Qigong retreat that got canceled. So that's a lot of income. I also have two clients locally, one here across from Grant High and one in Milwaukee, that I cook for and deliver food to, and they are both elderly. So I am considered essential, so I still have half my income. So I can still function, and I still go to the stores and be out and do that kind of stuff. But personally, I stay busy, but I am very sad about all the retreats, because the retreats are what I love the most.
Although you have less clients right now, you're doing pretty much the same thing that you did before. Is that right?
That's correct. But one different thing is, for my two clients, I just drop the food off at their door. I don't go in the house. At Haishan, as soon as I walk in, I take my Lysol handy wipes and I wipe every surface that I'll be touching. And I wear gloves. And I ask them not to come into my area of the kitchen. The dining room is separate. That's on the other side of this big, huge island. The island is probably 8 feet by 4 feet. And I wear gloves. So, and when I leave, I sterilize everything again. So, you know, things have changed. It's not business as usual, and I'm hyper aware, because I need my space to be clean. Every time I walk in my house, I take the Lysol wipes and I start at my front door. I wipe every surface that I'm going to be touching, and then when I get in my car, I do the same thing. I wipe everything in my car that I'm touching. So, and I wear gloves. So I need to make sure that I'm safe, so that I can keep providing nutritious, delicious food for my clients, and that I won't be, you know, they can trust me and feel safe of the measures that I'm taking.
I know that you have been working on sewing masks for medical personnel. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you got into that.
Well, last Tuesday or Wednesday, the CDC put out a desperate plea for anybody who had a sewing machine and who had sewing skills to make masks for the medical community. And it was very specific, and they posted a video of a woman making a mask. It was very simple, very easy, 6 inches by 9 inch rectangle with 3 pleats on each side and quarter inch elastic to go around the ear. I'm a seamstress. I'm an accomplished seamstress. I've made wedding dresses, suits, bridesmaid dresses. I can pretty much make anything. And so when I heard that, I thought, oh, this is something I can help. I can help in a movement that can help the medical community. And then so many opposing arguments on Facebook and opposing arguments for and against. I've seen so many messages saying, yes, we need the masks. Yes, somebody will pick up the mask. There'll be a designated location. Yes, yes, yeah, all this. And then others saying, no, nobody's going to use them. Nobody wants them. Stop making them. And then I saw another one. Yes, we need them. Keep making. So I don't know what to do. I have 50 cut out, and I'm basically waiting for a huge order of elastic to come in tomorrow. So I'm going to make those 50. And when I was at the fabric store, I talked to two biochemists that work in the medical field, and they found a fabric to put in between the two layers, because the CDC said, just do 2 layers. That's better than nothing. It's better that they have something on their face than nothing. Well, these biochemists found the fabric. They did research and found that Tyvek, which is the fabric used to make those suits, was available. There was a bolt there at a fabric store. So I said, are you going to buy the whole bolt? And they said, we'll buy 10 yards. And I said, okay, I'll take a few. And the woman behind me wanted a few, so we split it. And I have that to make, I think I have enough to put in 25 masks. So those masks will be dedicated for people in the medical community. And then I'll make the other masks maybe to have on hand if for personal use. You know, if somebody needs masks, at least they'll be made. But I really don't know how it's going to affect the medical community. I was hoping that they would be able to use them, but now I'm not so sure. So I'm still making them. I still want to help where I can, but I'm just not sure it's going to be originally what I thought it was going to be.
So there's a lot of fear and uncertainty at the moment concerning everything about the pandemic. I'm wondering, have you found any particular ways to cope and keep yourself moving forward despite these fears?
Well, I try to not choose fear. I have tried to just choose to be safe, to make myself safe, keep myself safe, do everything I can. My neighbors that live very close to me, tell them to be safe because they're younger. They're in their 20s and early 30s, and they worked at a bar, but of course bars are closed, so they're unemployed. But I just want them to be safe. I wasn't fearful until I went to Whole Foods yesterday, the day before, and the shelves were empty. And then I got a little bit panicky and a little bit, oh my gosh, what's happening? Because it was another step towards almost like apocalyptic approach, you know, thinking, because why are our shelves empty, you know? And so that was the first time that I felt a little bit of anxiety. Otherwise, I just feel like if I'm doing everything I can to sterilize and be safe and, you know, do the social distancing. I did go on a hike the other day, which was very healing. I highly recommend. But now they've closed the parks because people weren't social distancing. They were, you know, gathering in large groups as soon as all of this happened last week. And the mayor and the governor said, you know, we're suggesting stay at home, shelter in place, but it's not an order yet. So when that happened, all the people were laid off. They went to the beach and went to the parks and were still gathering in big, huge groups. And I thought, oh my gosh. So when I went on this hike, there were only 4 people on the hike. It was beautiful. I loved it. I thought, I'm going to go on a hike every few days. But now the parks are closed. So I've been walking in my neighborhood. And I live very close to Williams, so Williams was also quite apocalyptic with nobody around. You know, it's a big bicycle thoroughfare, and it's a very busy thoroughfare street, and it's usually parked with so many cars that me as a neighbor, if I want to go visit any of those businesses, I need to walk because there's never any parking. Well, there was nobody parked, and so it is very eye-opening to see what's really happening. You know, you can almost pretend that it's not happening. If you're sheltering in place and you're staying home, you can almost pretend, oh, I'm just hanging out at home, it's my day off. But then when you see those things, it really kind of strikes a little bit of fear, because it's the unknown. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. And then we didn't have a leader in the White House that knows how to handle this or deal with it, and that's probably the most fearful thing for me, is that our country is in peril and that guy doesn't know what the heck he's doing. So that's probably the most fearful thing for me, is for our country. I think the community will be okay, but the country, I don't know.
A lot of people are saying that we probably will not go back to the same normal that we had before. Do you have a sense of what good might come out of this situation?
Well, humanity, I mean, we as a humanity are good people. You know, I think that I don't like that we're so distant. I think the bad thing that will come out is that we will be so disconnected from people, because everything's a Zoom chat now, or everything's a Google chat, or everything's streaming this and streaming that. I don't know what good will come out of it, because if we can't go to the theater and see Broadway or see musicals or see the symphony or see, you know, that is what we thrive on, is human connection and human contact. And I don't know what good will come out of it. It just seems like right now only the negative will come out of it, because already our the youth of our country and the youth of the world are so attached to their devices that you'll see a picnic table with 6 or 8 kids and they're not communicating to each other. They're on their phones texting to each other. So that's already happened. Just imagine now if we don't have human contact, how bad that will be. We'll just be in pods.
If you were talking to somebody in a different place in the world, would there be anything you would want to tell them?
I'd say just be safe, stay safe, do what everybody tells you to, wash your hands, and let's see if we can get to the other side of this. It's just such an unknown. For everybody, for the government, for the community, for the world, it's such an unknown. Everybody's saying it's so unprecedented. We've never seen this in their lifetime. I was listening to podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts, which I love. And one woman, she's 75, and she said she's never seen this in her lifetime. And so that's the scary thing. And I, like I said, I don't want to go into the side of fear. I just want to do whatever I can to help my community and help get over the peak and flatten the curve and move forward and get through it. You know, the whole toilet paper thing, oh my gosh, I still haven't been able to buy toilet paper. And as a chef, I go to the store many times a week, and I checked 5 different stores on one day, and there's no damn toilet paper. you know, it's just things like that that can open my eyes to a little bit of fear, because it's such a drastic change from a week ago, you know what I mean? And that is one thing I am seeing, is people are willing to help their community. On Next Door Neighbor, which is where I asked to get elastic for people, people were willing to drop it off to me. I saw somebody, there's an IT guy on Next Door Neighbor that says, I'm willing to help you for no money, just give me toilet paper or pay it forward somehow. And I saw another message saying, if anybody needs groceries, let me know. I'm healthy, I can bring you groceries. So that is something that's good, is seeing how people are willing to help when, you know, maybe a week ago you would never see that. You know, people move on with their lives, business as usual. So that is something good, that the the community coming together and willing to help.
Yes.
So I have been speaking today with Teresa Estrada, who is a chef and a professional seamstress who has been making masks to help medical professionals, hopefully. Thank you so much for talking with us today on KBOO.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Suzanne. And thank you for all the programs on KBOO. I really treasure it.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and I have been speaking today with Teresa Estrada, Portland resident, personal chef, and professional seamstress who has been sewing masks in her spare time. Thank you so much for being on KBOO Community Radio News. Thank you.